The content of this program is intended for a print, visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Going to be reading articles from volume 57, number 2, which is the spring 2018 edition of Tar Heel Junior Historian. It's called Blackbeard: Secrets from Queen Anne's Revenge. We're going to be resuming an article called How Do You Save a Sunken Ship? Conserving Blackbeard's Queen Anne's Revenge. There are 6 steps involved. And last time we read about the first 3, which were exradiation, concretion, and desalination. So now we're going to resume with step 4, which is called bulking and consolidation. This is written by Karen Martindale, who is a conservator at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab. She earned her Master's of Art at Texas A&M University, where she helped excavate and conserve artifacts from shipwrecks in Sri Lanka, the Gulf Coast of Texas, and Savannah, Georgia. Once the salts are removed from the desalination step, there is more to be done before the artifacts can dry. The largest organic artifacts, like the wood hull planking, may look like they did when they were made hundreds of years ago, but they are actually very fragile. This is because they have been in water for so long that the water has dissolved and replaced most of the cellular structures that once gave the organic artifacts their shape. If the water dries, the cells collapse, causing the artifacts to shrink, twist, and even crumble. To dry the artifacts safely, conservators must first replace the water with something denser that can support the artifact during and after drying, in a process called bulking. The material used most often is polyethylene glycol, a wax-like substance that is solid at room temperature but can be melted and dissolved in water. You can even find it in everyday products like lotion and toothpaste. Organics aren't the only materials that need a little help to keep looking good. Glass and ceramics are often immersed in or coated with special diluted glues. This process is called consolidation and can help keep brittle or fragile artifacts together. Though you may not think it, metals are very sensitive to their environment. Moisture and oxygen cause iron to rust or oxidize, and copper to turn green. So one of the last conservation steps for metals is to paint on protective coatings. Copper is coated with a layer of special diluted glue. Because iron is so vulnerable to rusting, it gets 2 coatings. Tannic acid, which as a side effect gives the iron a black surface, and wax or diluted glue. There's a photograph with this article, and its caption is, conservators Terry Williams, Eric Farrell, Adriana DeMucci, and Michelle Crepeau apply tannic acid to the surface of a cannon. Step 5, documentation, by Jeremy Borelli, who is an archaeologist at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab. He has participated in several maritime archaeological projects, both nationally and internationally, in South Africa and Costa Rica. He joined the Queen Anne's Revenge team in 2012 and has worked in varied capacities as a lab technician and as a diver at the shipwreck site. Conservators use many different skills to help preserve and interpret the past, including photography and art. Archaeological photography provides a real representation or visual record of an artifact at that point in time. Several considerations influence a photographer's choice when taking artifact photos, including exposure, lighting, perspective, and lens focal length. Lighting, for example, can be altered to highlight certain markings on an artifact, like graffiti on lead cannon aprons. Queen Anne's Revenge artifacts go through big changes from when they are fresh from the seafloor to when they're ready to be shipped to the museum. To document these changes, artifacts go through several stages of photographic documentation. Photos are first taken immediately after recovery from the site. With each additional step of treatment, new photos are taken. After conservation, artifacts are photographed on a clean background in a photography studio. In every photo, scales are placed alongside the objects as a point of reference. The photographic series of artifacts gives future archaeologists, like you, the ability to compare images and see how an object has changed throughout the entire conservation process. Once an artifact is finished with treatment, the last step of the process is to create a technical illustration of the artifact. Why illustrate an artifact when there are so many photos of it already? Illustrations are better at conveying an object's overall dimensions on a single image. You can take a photo of a house, but you need a blueprint to see how it's built inside and out. By omitting certain stylistic techniques and using a variety of technical conventions, archaeological illustrations become more like interpretive diagrams than artistic or realistic portrayals of an artifact. Each form of documentation adds to the steadily growing archaeological, historical, and scientific record for Queen Anne's Revenge. There are two photographs. The first caption is, "This image of a delicate drinking glass fragment was taken in a photo studio. Then an artist made a technical drawing to create a more detailed record." And the second photograph's captioned, "Details on this lead cannon apron were hard to see at first. A photographer used a raking light to highlight the marks." Step 6, Dry Storage and Museum Transfer, by Karen Martindale. The key to preserving the finished artifacts for as long as possible is to control their storage environment, especially humidity, the amount of water vapor in the air. Organic artifacts do best with the relative humidity around 50%, just like what you have in your house or classroom. High humidity can lead to mold growth, but low humidity can make organic artifacts brittle. Other artifacts, such as iron, need a very dry environment to prevent rust from forming, so conservators use dehumidifiers and silica gel to lower the humidity as much as possible. Temperature and humidity monitors help conservators maintain the ideal storage environment for each type of artifact. Once all conservation and documentation is complete, the artifacts are ready to be transferred to the North Carolina Maritime Museum in Beaufort, where the curators use the artifacts to create exhibits about Blackbeard and Queen Anne's Revenge. They also loan artifacts to other museums, including the Museum of History in Raleigh, the Museum of the Albemarle in Elizabeth City, the Graveyard of the Atlantic Museum in Hatteras, and the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. They have even developed a traveling exhibit celebrating the 300th anniversary of Blackbeard's adventures along the North Carolina coast. There's one photo, and its caption is, "Storage in a dehydration box will help prevent rust on this iron cannon." There's also an extra article, "Think about it. Do you think Blackbeard and his pirate crew ever thought about the year 2018 when they were roaming the seas in 1718? What would they think about all the work being done on the artifacts or objects from their ship? What would they think about their stuff being displayed in museums? What would they think about you dressing up like a pirate and reading all about them in an issue of Tar Heel Junior Historian magazine? What if pirates from 1718 could look at artifacts from your life? What would they learn about you? What has changed in 300 years? And what has stayed the same?" The next article is Shipboard Life. What was on a pirate's plate? It's written by Sarah Watkins Kenny. Sarah Watkins Kenny has been at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab since 2003. She has a degree in archaeological conservation from Cardiff University and a master's degree in museum and gallery management from City University in London, and is also studying for a PhD in coastal resources management at East Carolina University. After Blackbeard's ship Queen Anne's Revenge ran aground, it was abandoned by the pirates, but they did not take everything with them. Ordinary things that they left behind, such as plates and dishes, give us clues about life aboard the ship. Archaeologists have so far been able to excavate, which means to dig out and remove an object such as an artifact in the ground, ocean, or river, have been able to excavate 20 plates and 10 dishes from Queen Anne's Revenge. The plates found are 8 to 11 inches in diameter. The dishes are 12 inches or more in diameter, and the biggest one is almost 2 feet across. The archaeologists had lots of questions. They wanted to know, what were the plates and dishes made of? When, where, and by whom were they made? Were they used for eating? If so, what food was on the plate, and how was it cooked? What did the pirates drink with their food? How did they store food and drink on the ship? Where did the pirates go shopping to get their provisions? At the Queen Anne's Revenge Conservation Lab in Greenville, archaeological conservators carefully cleaned and investigated the plates and dishes using microscopes, X-ray machines, and chemical analysis. They discovered the plates and dishes were made of pewter, a metal alloy that is a mixture of tin, antimony, and copper. Careful cleaning also revealed fine crisscross lines on plate fronts, visible best when viewed under a magnifying glass or microscope. Like a plastic plate, a pewter plate is easily scratched by a knife used to cut up food on it, resulting in fine lines as seen on the Queen Anne's Revenge plates. We can imagine that the marks were made by the last pirate cutting up his dinner on the plate just as the ship ran aground and had to be abandoned, leaving behind their dinner still hot on the plate. But what food was on the pirate's plate? Archaeologists have also excavated bones from the shipwreck. No human bones, but bones of cattle, pig, turkey, turtle, deer, fish, and rat have been found. Fragments of corroded iron found on the shipwreck were discovered to be remains of iron cauldrons, perhaps the very cauldrons in which the pirates cooked up the joints of meat, which they cut up with knives, which marked the pewter plates they were eating from, which they left behind when they abandoned the ship. But how did they cook the meat in cauldrons? From historic records, such as paintings and early cookery books, we know that a common cooking method in the late 17th and early 18th centuries was cauldron cookery. All the ingredients for dinner, such as the meat, butter, herbs, vegetables, and puddings, would be cooked at the same time in the same cauldron of boiling water. To boil the water and its contents, the cauldron was suspended over a fire. In the early 18th century, there was no electricity, no gas, no microwave ovens or barbecue grills for cooking. To boil water and cook food, a fire was needed. But such a fire on board a wooden ship was very dangerous, as the ship itself could catch fire if something went wrong. Another artifact found, however, gives us clues about how the food might have been cooked safely on the ship. Ceramic bricks from a brick oven or floor in the galley aboard ship would not have burned like wood if a spark from the fire fell on them. Other artifacts found give us some clues about drinking on board. Amazingly, four glass onion-shaped wine bottles were found complete and unbroken. They survived the wrecking of the ship, its disintegration on the seabed, and 300 years under the sea. These bottles were used to serve wine at table. The wide bottom made them stable and not likely to fall over and spill if the ship rocked while sailing through rough seas during dinner. Fragments of delicate drinking glasses have also been found. These could have been used for wine or perhaps a pirate punch. On a ship in the early 18th century, there was not a lot of space for storing food and drink. The Queen Anne's Revenge was about 100 feet long, 30 feet wide, and about 25 feet from main deck to bottom of hold. There were more than 300 pirates on board when it ran aground. Where and how was enough food and drink for all these people stored on the ship? At that time, the most common way to store provisions in bulk was in casks or barrels. Casks were usually packed into the hold, the lowest level of the ship. Casks were made of curved wood staves held together by wood or iron hoops. The skill of the cooper making the casks was critical to ensure hoops remained tight on the cask so that its contents did not leak out. Many ships had a cooper on board. They looked after the casks, made sure they did not leak, and that no food or drink was secretly taken of pirates looking for a snack. The cooper aboard Queen Anne's Revenge was Edward Salter, who was captured by the pirates from another ship, Margaret, near the Caribbean island of St. Kitts on December 5, 1717. No complete casks or even wooden staves have been found on the Queen Anne's Revenge shipwreck, but very big iron hoops that would have been around casks were recovered. From the hoop diameters, we can calculate that some casks were a size known as hogsheads, which could measure up to 3 feet in diameter. Some of these may have been on the ship when it was the slave trade vessel La Concorde, with more than 500 enslaved Africans on board. On the Atlantic crossing from Africa to the Americas, slave ships had to carry at least one hogshead of water for every person on board, as well as enough food for all. Today, we use refrigerators and freezers to keep food and drink cold, fresh, and safe to eat. In the 18th century, there were no refrigerators or freezers. Imagine uncooked meat packed into something the size of a woodshed without air conditioning in the heat and humidity of a North Carolina summer. The meat would be very smelly and bad to eat within a day or less. It would not be long before water could go bad, too. Bad meat and water could cause food poisoning and even kill a person. Getting fresh provisions and preventing what they had from going bad was a major challenge for any ship's captain. If crews did not get enough safe food or drink, they would not be able to work the ship properly, and they might even mutiny if they were hungry, thirsty, and desperate enough. One way to have fresh food was to keep live chickens, pigs, and even cows on board. They could provide milk and eggs, and could be killed, cooked, and eaten straight away if needed. Ships also carried salted meat, beef or pork, packed in casks. The salt helped to stop the meat from going bad. Other food provisions carried dry in casks included flour, rice, and peas. In the 18th century, there were no supermarkets, computers, or online shopping. Fresh provisions had to be bought direct from local farmers and markets. Merchant ships tried to avoid going too long between harbors where they could get fresh provisions. But pirates could not easily put into harbors because they were on a stolen ship. If they did, they risked being arrested, tried, and hanged for the crime of piracy. Pirates could only get fresh provisions by taking them from other ships. From captains' log books, letters, newspaper articles, and witness accounts at pirate trials, we have reports of this kind of pirate shopping by members of Blackbeard's pirate fleet. From ships encountered in the Caribbean and the North Carolina coast, they took live hogs and cattle, casks of salted beef, flour, bread, butter, wine, beer, molasses, rum, and even fresh pineapples. Usually no payment was made for things taken, but sometimes the pirates gave something in exchange. Steed Bonnet, captain of Revenge, once exchanged rice for provisions taken from one ship encountered. Artifacts left behind when the pirates abandoned Queen Anne's Revenge and found by archaeologists 300 years later are giving us many clues about life aboard the ship. But as we get some answers to what was on a pirate's plate, more questions arise. For example, we have found only 20 pewter plates, but there were more than 300 people with Blackbeard when Queen Anne's Revenge ran aground. Where are their plates? Were they a different material, such as wood, that did not survive 300 years in the ocean? Did the pirates take their plates with them when they left the ship? Are their plates still at the site, not excavated yet? These are important and intriguing research questions that archaeologists, conservators, scientists, and historians will investigate as work on this North Carolina treasure continues. Here are some photo captions. A close-up of a pewter plate shows the cut marks left by the knives used by pirates while eating aboard Queen Anne's Revenge. One amazing discovery was this glass, onion-shaped bottle, one of four that were found complete and unbroken. They survived a shipwreck and more than 300 years at the bottom of the sea. This cauldron, or large pot, from Queen Anne's Revenge tells us that Blackbeard and his pirate probably used a popular cooking method called cauldron cookery. All the ingredients for dinner were tossed into the same cauldron of boiling water to cook over a fire. Here's a sidebar. Did you know? On the backs of some QAR plates and dishes, researchers found maker's marks or hall marks, small marks that tell us where the plates were made and by whom. One maker's name identified is John Stiles. From historical records, we know he was a pewterer in London, England from 1689 to about 1730. Other marks found on the backs of some plates were the word London, an X, and a rose pattern, which suggests this was good quality pewter. It looks like pirates only stole the best. There's a photograph with it, and its caption says, "Look closely. Time and the sea have worn down this maker's mark, but can you still find part of the words London, John, and Styles?" This tells us that this plate from Queen Anne's Revenge was made by the pewterer John Styles from London, England. The next article is Pirate Treasure, It's Not What You Think. Books and movies are filled with stories about pirate treasure. We often imagine treasure chests overflowing with diamonds and rubies and gold. But what was really in those treasure chests? Pirates stole gold, silver, weapons, and cargo that they could sell. Any passengers aboard? Pirates stole their personal valuables, too. They also went shopping for food and drink. Here's some of the treasure you would find on a pirate ship. Salt. Salt had great value because people needed it for seasoning food and preserving meat. Weapons. Swords, small arms, and especially gunpowder were valuable. Pirates and colonists alike found them indispensable. Tea and coffee. The popular beverages tea and coffee were smuggled throughout the colonies to avoid British taxes. Sugar. Sugar, made from cane grown in the West Indies, came in cones. It was so expensive that colonists kept it locked up in special wooden boxes. Spices. People would pay high prices for rare and valuable flavorings, such as cocoa, vanilla, cinnamon, and cloves. Bottles. Pirates drank rum themselves and often smuggled it into the colonies to sell. And medicines. Pirates used and sold medicinal herbs, ointments, and painkillers. Medicines had great value because they were in short supply. The accompanying photograph has its caption, "Buried treasure? Sadly, mostly a myth. Only Captain Kidd was known to have buried treasure to hide his ill-gotten goods." In this photograph are identified cloves, cocoa, vanilla beans, and cinnamon sticks. Next article is Fire in the Hole by Eric Farrell, who is an objects conservator at the Queen Anne's Revenge Lab. He has a long-standing interest in the archaeology, history, and conservations of weapons and armor, and he leads the lab teams for artillery conservation. Blackbeard's flagship may have carried up to 40 cannon. Underwater archaeologists have found 30 so far. There's a photograph with a caption, "Divers help in the 2013 raising of a cannon still covered in concretion. Compare it to the clean and restored Canon C24 on the opposite page," which on this side you can have, it has also photographs with the captions, "You can see the identifying 713 mark on Canon C27, and though the mark is harder to see on Canon C4, you can still make out the letters IF. And at the bottom of the page, there is a Canon, and it shows the different parts of the cannon. At the opening, it's called a muzzle, and then the next section in is the chase. And then there are trunnions, and the second reinforce, followed by the first reinforce, the vent field, and in the far back, the cascabel. And the caption with this photograph is, "Many hours and lots of hard, careful conservation work turned Canon C24, a 9-foot, 6-pounder, into a stunningly beautiful artifact. Imagine the stories it was part of while on board the Queen Anne's Revenge." There are a few things a pirate needs quite so much as guns, big guns, and the more the better. As a pirate, Blackbeard would have been very aware of this need to be armed. It was all well and good to catch another ship, but if you couldn't overpower your target, your career as a pirate would be short. Evidence and sources vary as to exactly how many cannon were aboard Queen Anne's Revenge. Archaeologists have found 30 so far, and historical records indicate the ship may have held up to 40 cannon. This made Queen Anne's Revenge a fast, relatively heavily armed ship, excellent for catching up to and capturing merchant vessels. In short, an ideal pirate ship. The cannon that the archaeologists have found on Queen Anne's Revenge are a mixed lot. There are many different sizes made by different people in different countries. So far, half-pounders, one-pounders, two-pounders, four-pounders, and six-pounders have been found. These numbers do not indicate how much the gun weighs. A cannon weighing half a pound would be tiny, but rather how much the cannonball fired by each gun weighs. The effective range of these weapons was quite short. The half-pounder was likely only useful at extremely close range immediately before boarding an enemy ship. The one- and two-pounders have an effective range of approximately 100 to 200 yards. Four- and six-pounders have an effective range of 300 to 500 yards. The bigger guns would have been more useful in chasing down, damaging, and disabling a prize ship, while the smaller guns would have likely been used to target enemy sailors before trying to capture and board their ship. We've run out of time for today's episode of Independent Living. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. If you have any comments, concerns, or questions, please call 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.